This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. What's old is new. People concerned about development incentives could look back to the community collection to keep the Chicago and Alton Railroad yards open on Bloomington's west side.
So we tend to think of corporate giveaways today as being relatively new, of being controversial, but in fact that policy goes all the way back a century.
Bill Kemp of the McLean County Museum of History talks with John Norton about his new book. Find out who is most likely to sexually harass. Charlie Schlenker talks with an ISU scholar who has developed a test indicating who may be likely to engage in such behavior. And hear about a huge donation to ISU's Circus and Allied Arts Collection at Milner Library. Laura Kennedy has the interview. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's January 16th, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. As sexual harassment scandals continue to be at the top of the national conversation, we turn to decades-old research done in Central Illinois about why people sexually harass. ISU psychologist John Pryor developed a test back in the 1980s that predicts who is likely to engage in sexual harassment. In this conversation with GLT's Charlie Schlenker, Pryor says sexual harassment is the product of both the proclivities of a man who is wielding power in an improper way and an environment that encourages it.
So you have some men who have a proclivity, if you will, for this kind of behavior. And we actually looked at behaviors like this in controlled laboratory studies. Even men who have that proclivity, though, typically don't do that kind of behavior unless there's some sort of permission given by the social norms in the situation they're in. So if they, for example, are around somebody who provides kind of a bad role model for that sort of thing, then they're more likely to do it. Or if they see other people doing it in their environment, they're more likely to do it. But if they're in situations where there are professional norms, then they're unlikely to do it.
You actually created conditions where sexual harassment could and would happen. How did that come about? How did you find people with those tendencies? How labor-intensive is that?
You bring in, say, 500 people, 500 undergraduates. You put them through this thing called mass testing. It's not done that much anymore at ISU. We used to do it every semester. But mass testing is basically you give people a variety of different kinds of questionnaires on personality dimensions, attitude dimensions, spanning a whole bunch of different things because they reflect the interest of lots of different faculty. People who would take those things, would take them in large auditoriums. They would take them with it's called an informed consent document that tells them that they're completely anonymous and they should be honest, you know, and answer these questions. And at the end of doing all that, what we would do is we would say, okay, you have the right to continue to remain completely anonymous, but if you want to help us out and do some additional studies in the future, why don't you give us your name and your phone number? And almost everybody did. So they basically divulge their identities voluntarily. So we would call them up then maybe a month later, and we would bring them into the laboratory, and we would look at their behaviors under some socially engineered kinds of conditions. It's also labor intensive in that we had not only a person, usually a graduate student, who was actually conducting the study, but we also had Confederates, so women who we had trained to basically be the targets of sexual harassment were part of the situation we were socially engineering. Now, these people were also undergraduates, and they're people who work with me. They're people who knew what they were getting into. That's one thing. It's important, so there's no surprises. Also, we did some things to try to assure their sense of security while they were participating in these things.
I was going to say, because having made yourself vulnerable or a target, there's a potential for it creeping out of the lab setting.
Well, We never had any reports of that. And the other thing that we had as a standard procedure was the women who were our Confederates, we called them, knew that at any time, if things started to get out of hand or crossed a line into something that they did not feel that they could handle in some way, there was this big burly graduate student who was in the hallway, and he would come in at, you know, a second's notice. So
how far did the behavior go?
They didn't. So one of the things we looked at was a behavior that I generically called unsolicited sexual touching. It didn't go as far as, say, the kinds of behaviors that Trump says that he did. Didn't do that kind of thing. Nor did it involve touching a woman's breasts or something like that. It was more by putting their arms around them and squeezing their shoulders, things like that, that were what we found. So we never found women who said that our Confederates saying that, you know, he tried to touch my genitals or he tried to touch my breasts or that kind of thing. That never happened.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Pryor, a distinguished professor emeritus of Illinois State University in psychology. You would think, though, that people know this stuff is out of line, and yet they're still copping to it on the survey, and they're still doing it.
A couple things about that. Let me address that issue, and I think that's a good point. With regard to the survey itself, let's look at that first. Remember, when people took the survey initially, when they took this questionnaire, this likelihood to sexually harass questionnaire, they did it under conditions where they were told, you're completely anonymous here, and try to be honest because you are anonymous. And only later did they divulge their identity. So at the time they were taking the survey itself, or the questionnaire itself, they were under the impression that they would continue to be anonymous. So that was one part. The other thing is, when you look at what we found in those studies, and this is a real important part of our findings, people do these kinds of things under circumstances where there's some sense of which these kinds of behaviors have been permitted or legitimized. We, in one study, had a graduate student who basically modeled sexually harassing behavior. So what he did was talk to a woman in a way, kind of flirting kind of way, and he kind of touched her back and things along those lines. In essence, when you see somebody who is a person in a position of authority do those kinds of things, it kind of legitimizes that sort of behavior. So
that certainly is going to take effect in the workplace. But as a cultural norm, have things changed? You would think that attitudes have changed on the surface, and the public speech surrounding sexually harassing behavior has changed over the last 30-plus years. But has the behavior as revealed in the surveys changed as well?
Well, let me say something about a recent study that I did. I participated with a group of people who are sexual harassment researchers in a project that the New York Times sponsored, and we put together a different kind of survey. We asked people where they'd actually done things in the last year. And we included some of the kinds of sexually harassing behaviors that have been studied in countless other studies. But they include sexual coercion. They include something called unwanted sexual attention, which is kind of repeated requests for dates, even though you've been told no. And it also included something that we called gender harassment, which is basically hostile sexist behavior, calling women sexist names or telling sexist jokes in the workplace, things along those lines. What we found in the study, which was a national sample of 615 working men, that 25% of the men in the sample said they had done at least one of those things in the last year. I can also say in a pilot study that I did before that with kind of more of a convenient sample, but a sample of working men nonetheless, I find if you extended the time frame out to last 5 years, you get 76% of men saying they've done at least one of those things.
Wow.
And last year. Now, that study is one that I hope to replicate with a larger, more scientific sample. But the New York Times sample was a scientific sample. That's one you can kind of take to the bank with regard to it not being something that selective or that kind of thing.
Is it power? Is it sex?
It's both. It's both power and sex, particularly when you want to talk about something like sexual coercion, because by definition, if you're coercing someone, you have some sort of power over them. You can either bribe them or you can punish them. Some of the things, though, that are interestingly connected to I don't know whether it's individual power, but it's sort of male power in some way. One of the things that I found and other people have found is that men who admit to performing sexually harassing behaviors, and this is no shock here, they tend to be more sexist. They tend to be people who basically categorically demean women or look at women in a general negative kind of combative sort of way, so the war of the sexes kind of thing. Sexist men are more likely to do all the different kinds of sexually harassing behaviors that we've studied. So that comes through in a great many studies.
Is sexual harassment more common the longer a person is in a powerful position?
Well, I don't know if there's any good answer to that question. One of the things I will tell you, though, is that people who are in powerful positions come to believe that those they have power over are attracted to them. There are some clever studies that have been done where you can actually give people power and find that there's that relationship. And there are other studies that look at people who are in positions where they've actually had power. There may be some connection of sexual harassment, this more coercive kind of thing, and sort of being, kind of newly in a position of power. There's some research that seems to indicate that. So if you hadn't had power before, but now you're in power, then
that activates you.
That activates it, yeah. But for that to happen, you have to have this sort of connection in your mind between sex and power. There's some complicated relationships when we think about, is it sex or is it power? I would generally say, that it can be both.
But what's to like about non-consent?
What's to like about non-consent?
That is, seems foreign to a lot of people.
I think that for some people, dominating someone is something that's kind of a sexual charge. It is actually a function of sexuality. For men who score high in the likelihood to sexually harass scale, I've asked them that kind of question before. So they look at sex as, you ask them, well, why do you have sex? You know, there are lots of reasons people have sex, and some of them have to do with domination and power exertion, things like that. And people who have this proclivity for sexual coercion are likely to see, well, dominance is one of the reasons you have sex. Some other things that they talk about are kind of hedonism, also things like a relief from boredom and to sort of impress your friends, things along those lines. One of the things you don't see as often in men who are likely to sexually harass is some sense that sex is about some sort of intimacy between two people. So that's also a function of sex. It's a very common one for most people, one of the more prominent ones, that you have sex with people you love, with people, it makes you feel intimate with the person you have sex with. And that's not what people who are likely to sexually coerce are likely to feel about sex.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with John Pryor, a distinguished professor emeritus of Illinois State University, about his landmark gold standard study about the likelihood of someone would be a sexual harasser. If people have these attitudes, and if they know it's wrong and do it anyway, how can they be changed?
I guess I would kind of take exception to the idea they know it's wrong and they do it anyway. I think that some people feel entitled to exert themselves. Entitlement is unfortunately something that many people in power seem to feel. That is, because they have wealth and power, they think that they deserve it and they deserve all that goes with it.
Is it fixable?
I think it's fixable in a sense that I think that if you work towards having more women in positions of power and authority in organizations and institutions throughout the country, that's going to be something that's going to undermine the degree to which people who work in those organizations are going to be likely to do these kinds of things. For one thing, if your boss is a female as compared to a male, and you have this kind of thing happen to you, you're more likely to think that you'll be believed when you go complain. There's a suspicion often among women, and I think it's one that's One that they come by honestly is that they complain and they're not believed, they say, oh, well, there's another way to look at this from the perspective of the person who's doing these things to you. That's something that they're going to fear less if the person who is their supervisor is someone who's a woman.
John Pryor is a distinguished professor emeritus of psychology at Illinois State University. He's been much in demand recently to help explain the national scandal and national sexual harassment scandal. Pryor spoke with GLT's Charlie Schlenker for Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, now offering short-term stays and assisted living up to 30 days. For supervision following minor injury, illness, or surgery, or for families or caregivers who are going out of town or need a break. Details at lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, hear about a huge donation of items, some one-of-a-kind and rare pieces, to the ISU Circus and Allied Arts Collection at Milner Library. Laura Kennedy has that interview ahead during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. McLean County Museum of History librarian Bill Kemp's new collection of stories he's written for the Pantograph reveal issues from McLean County's past that still reverberate today, albeit in different form. Volume 2 of Bill Kemp's Pages from the Past covers a variety of people and events, including McLean County's history with hemp, railroads, and JCPenney. He also talked to GLT's John Norton about McLean County's history of racial segregation in schools, including a famous court case in the late 1800s, interesting because it was not arguing on racial grounds, but on finance.
Chase v. Stevenson was an early civil rights case relating to education that has its origin in McLean County. It was a small one-room school in outside of Danvers. There were several rural black families living in the area, which was not unusual for the time. African Americans, though they were never particularly numerous in rural McLean County, there were African American farmhands in some smaller communities. There were African American barbers. So certain areas of the county were known to have small pockets of African Americans, Danvers being one of them. So there were several African American children wanting to attend this one-room school. The local school board decided it was best that they create a separate school for these few black children. Several taxpayers within the one-room school district then were upset over the fact that, in effect, this was costing them money. In effect, they were paying for two schools when one school would be more than sufficient for the number of children in the school district. So the case begins in the McLean County Circuit Court. The case then ends up in the Illinois Supreme Court and is known as kind of an early test case for school segregation. Although the case is really argued on the basis of finance, not so much in the issue of race or equality or civil rights.
Right. So
the main issue was really that taxpayers within the district believed that the school district was being unfair to them because it was making them pay for an additional second school when one was not needed.
They won the case, right?
Correct, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting how, it'd be almost a half a century later when housing covenants and neighborhood associations back then, they were trying to exclude especially African Americans on that exact basis because property values would go down, right?
We tend to forget a lot of some of the darker chapters in local history. For example, in the post-World War II era, one of the things celebrated in American culture and history, as it should be, is the GI Bill, allowing middle class, working class, former servicemen, GIs, right, to begin the family dream of owning a home and starting a family in oftentimes kind of like a Levittown subdivision, a new subdivision, large backyards, playground equipment, a lot of young families. We had plenty of neighborhoods such as that in Bloomington and Normal. Unfortunately, locally, as was the case in much of America, even though the GI Bill did not restrict anybody because of race, local practices, that is local bankers, brokers, local realtors, local folk, community leaders really ensured that African Americans were going to be limited in their ability to purchase new homes in these new post-war subdivisions. So even though in theory, African Americans could exercise some measure of equality when it came to housing, there was nothing like that in Bloomington Normal until the mid to late 60s, if not later, and we still have problems in this community today.
You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. We're talking with McLean County Museum of History librarian Bill Kemp. His brand new book is Pages from the Past, a collection of stories from the Sunday Pantograph, which he contributes to regularly. Let's talk about marijuana and hemp and how that's back in the news big time, because a lot of people want to legalize the use of marijuana, and some are saying there's a big difference between marijuana and hemp. But McLean County has a really interesting hemp history.
During the World War II era, Lexington was the regional or local center for wartime cultivation of hemp. Hemp was needed during the war as we lost our supply of fiber in the Pacific for rope and cordage for the Navy, for shroud lines and harnesses for airborne troops. Lexington became the center. Area farmers then began to grow hemp, and there was a local processing mill just outside of Lexington to process hemp into kind of a rough form then, which was shipped outside of the area then to be further processed. So one of the slogans at the time was we were going to hang Hitler with a hemp rope in a way.
Oh, wow. So hemp at that time didn't have the stigma that it does today. Is that accurate?
Well, people were aware that it could be a problematic crop, certainly. So there were restrictions in growing it. Farmers had to keep extremely detailed records. You had to plant protective strips of crops to prevent that hemp from then spreading itself out into ditches and beyond its fields. It had a very low THC content, so it was difficult really to get any sort of psychoactive feel off of it. But nonetheless, it still had some of those properties. But the war trumped all at that time.
Let's talk about retail. Bloomington's downtown used to be, you know, thriving, like a lot of downtowns, right? Could you talk about how that turned?
So one of the pieces I look at is JCPenney, one of three national department stores based in downtown Bloomington.
Were the other two, the national one?
Sears was downtown and Montgomery Ward's was downtown as well.
All right.
So in addition to that, you had four locally owned department stores, Livingston's, Clem's, Roland's, and during the Depression, my store, which then will go under during the Great Depression. So within roughly three or four blocks of each other, you had at one time seven department stores. So you could imagine, especially during the holiday season, how crowded downtown sidewalks would be, especially around the Courthouse Square, where a lot of these department stores were located. JCPenney moved into the Braley Field Building, which is at the northwest corner of the Courthouse Square. McGuire's Bar and Grill currently occupies the Braley Field Building, at least the first floor. So to think about a national department store inhabiting such a relatively small retail space, but such was the way things were handled back then. Of course, that begins to change with the post-war era in the late 1940s, early 1950s, with the rise of the automobile and the middle-class consumerist culture. Bloomington Normal, just like all communities of its size, begins to expand. Folks with automobiles have a little bit more mobility. You're beginning to locate factories in green spaces outside of the city center or the older manufacturing belts. And then you're going to begin to move retail. In the case of Bloomington Normal, retail then was moved out to the Route 66 Beltline, which we now know as Veterans Parkway. Beginning in the early 1960s, Kmart was really the first retailer to make a stake out on the Beltline. People thought at the time in the early 1960s that it was a somewhat foolish move, but of course we can see today how visionary that really was. And then Eastland Mall begins to be developed in the early 1960s, and in many ways that's the death knell for downtown Bloomington being the retail hub of not only the Twin Cities.
I want to talk about technology and what a disruptor
technology is in general, from the internet disrupting retail so badly all over the country, including here in Bloomington and Normal. JCPenney is no longer here, and other retail. Can you talk about how technology has disrupted the Twin Cities and or McLean County over the decades, even over the century and a half?
One of the primary areas where technology has really impacted this area is in transportation. You cannot tell the history of McLean County without talking about transportation. Let's go back to the 1820s when the first Euro-Americans or white settlers were moving into this part of central Illinois. Before the arrival of railroads in the mid-1850s of this part of the state, Bloomington, which is established as the county seat of McLean County in 1831, is really a backwater county seat. It has no growth potential without the arrival of railroads. It is nearly impossible to bring large amounts of bulky commodities in or out of this part of the state until the arrival of railroads. Once railroads arrive in the 1850s, that is an utter game changer. As I like to say, you could divide the history of our local community really into two grand eras, before railroads and after railroads. And railroads first arrived in Bloomington, McLean County in 1853 with the Illinois Central Railroad in the spring. We know that now as Constitution Trail, at least its roadbed. And then in the fall, a more important railroad locally for us will come to know that as the Chicago and Alton Railroad. That railbed still exists today as Union Pacific and Amtrak, and that is the single most important entry point into the local community for many, many decades until the rise, really, of the automobile in the 1920s, 1930s, and into the post-war era.
Well, and that dovetails, by the way, we're talking with Bill Kemp, librarian for the McLean County Museum of History. That dovetails into another issue that we're dealing with today and how much to pay people who want to come in and invest in McLean County, build a McLean County, put manufacturing in. But back in the day, there was a time, was it Union Pacific or who was it that they were thinking about moving out of town?
Chicago and Alton Railroad.
Okay, and the whole west side of Bloomington, right, was just, I mean, it was all about the railroads, like you said. It was huge. And if they would have moved out, that would have been devastating to especially the west side of Bloomington, right?
We think we are a Bloomington Normal, the Twin Cities. We are a white-collar community, and that is one of our strengths, really, in the post-industrial economy in the 21st century, based in insurance, education, medical care, and things of that nature. But Bloomington Normal, back in the 19th century, was, as were most communities of this size, it was a blue-collar community. We made things like vacuum cleaners and washing machines. And before the rise of State Farm in the 1920s and 1930s, the largest employer in the community from the time of the Civil War into the 1920s, if not a little bit later, were the Chicago and Alton Railroad shops and yards on the west side of Bloomington, literally a city unto itself. You had 1,500 to 1,800 skilled and semi-skilled men, carpenters, upholsterers, blacksmiths, tool and die makers, switchmen, brakemen, firemen, locomotive engineers, track workers, you name it. Like I said, a city unto itself, a hive of activity, because back in the 19th and into the 20th century, this nation, the world, moved by rail. So we had on the west side of Bloomington a Chicago and Alton Railroad shops where locomotives were primarily refurbished, restored, and repaired, and rolling stock was constructed and repaired as well. There was the threat to move the Chicago and Alton Railroad shops out of Bloomington to Springfield in the early 1900s. So the community banded together, both the city fathers, and back in the early 1900s, unfortunately, the city leaders were all male, and the West Side residents pooled their resources together and basically made a large cash donation and a donation of land to the Chicago and Alton Railroad to keep the shops in town, because the community realized that without the shops, the community would be in a much worse way. So we tend to think of corporate giveaways today as being relatively new, of being controversial, but in fact, that policy goes all the way back a century.
Volume 2 of Bill Kemp's Pages from the Past, a new collection of stories he's written for the Pantograph, is available at the McLean County Museum of History. You can also find it at the Garlic Press in Uptown Normal and Casey's Garden Shop in Bloomington. Kemp spoke with GLT's John Norton. You're listening to Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
I'm Mike McCurdy. The world-renowned Circus and Allied Arts Collection at Illinois State University's Milner Library just expanded by 250,000 items, many rare and one-of-a-kind pieces of circus history. Laura Kennedy has more.
You could call Herbert Eckert the ultimate circus superfan. The Sarasota, Florida man has been collecting circus items for decades and now has decided that Illinois State University's Milner Library is just the place for his vast and unique collection. Mark Schmidt, Senior Specialist in Special Collections, and Maureen Brunsdale, Special Collections Librarian, say they're both bowled over and excited by this magnanimous donation that contains a dizzying array of material.
Oh my gosh, where to start? Photographs, thousands of photographs. He gave us original poster art along with posters. He gave us props, costumes.
Negatives, slides, thousands and thousands and thousands upon thousands of things.
And his name is Herbert Eckert. Who is this guy?
He is a lifelong circus fan and enthusiast. He is a past president of Circus Fans Association of America. And he's a retired high school librarian from Las Vegas, Nevada. But throughout his entire life, his passion was circus. So he built up this collection.
Why did he decide to give this to Illinois State University? He lives in Sarasota, Florida. That is where the Ringling Museum is, and he's just a stone's throw from that. He could have driven over there and dumped some boxes off on the loading dock there, yet he decided to donate it here.
His passion is education. As a retired high school librarian, he sees the impact education has on students, and every donor has a choice to make where they want their materials left. If not in the family, then where's it going to go? Is it going to go to a museum where it's going to be displayed and people can learn from it in that way? Or is it going to come to a place like ISU where it can be integrated into the curriculum and students can learn from it and in that way bring circus back to life? And that's where that's what really resonated with him, is to bring it to Illinois State University where it's going to get used and people are going to learn from it.
So Mark, tell me about the possibilities for study here, all the different departments that we have here on campus, and you've got all these amazing things. So how can the university in general benefit from this really amazing donation?
You name it, from geography, the obvious, like circuses are like routed, and so they go all over the country, sometimes the world, and you have geography, family and consumer science.
Family and consumer science, how's that?
With the genealogical angle of it, with textile angle of it, art, of course.
So they could come up and maybe study some posters?
Absolutely. We have so many beautiful stone lithographed posters that it is not unusual to have instructors doing lithography or intaglio coming over here and studying those amazing posters.
Business students can learn from the marketing, from how much that these circuses were spending on their marketing materials, their posters in this instance. Musicians. We have a number of scores for circus music that capture the songs of the day. That's something that we don't think of with circus, but actually circus played a pivotal role in the days before radio of making popular music, spreading it throughout the country.
Well, you have some items that are out here on the table, and when I walked in, the very first thing that I noticed was a big head of a frog.
Yes.
So tell me
yes.
what this is.
Well, this came from Herb's collection. It is obviously a frog head used by a contortionist, and we have some photos of a contortionist there.
Okay, I need to know, why does a contortionist need a frog head?
You know, Mark and I were talking about this morning, and we're thinking, like, when we think of frogs, we think of rather sedentary or frogs that leap. But back in the day, and this would have been in the early teens and 1920s, there was a performer who would don this head and then have tights and a leotard, green ones, of course, to do his various contortion acts.
It does look like it's been through the ringer a bit. Do we know who specifically wore this?
Well, that's part of the joy, that we get to do some research to figure it out. Mark thinks that the gentleman we have pictured here was the Frogman.
I see some photos here. It says the Flexible Adonis.
This is Fred Lucier. He was performing late 19-teens up through maybe the 1940s. Very slender, tall, and beyond flexible. And again, this frog head, I cannot even imagine what that would look like as he's performing. There is a window for him to see out,
I see, and then a strap down there, too. It's just a screen, and it's painted, well, it was painted yellow, but it's kind of been worn off now. So that's, and that wouldn't have provided a whole lot of oxygen with that thing over his head.
Fred Lucier has a local connection in that he married a woman who, her sister, was part of the Bob Fischer's Five Fearless Flyers. That's Maxine Musselman. We have so much material from Fred Lucier and the Musselmans in this collection that it's really bowled us over.
Okay, so over here we have
some original poster art.
These are beautiful.
Aren't they fun? On the right-hand side, we have what my sister likes to call the most alluring woman in circus ever. Her name was Dorothy Herbert, and she was obviously an equestrian with Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey Circus for only a couple of seasons, but she had a very lengthy career. She has that come hither, look down pat, I think.
And that looks like it's from the 1930s, judging from her hairstyle.
Exactly. And we have the poster that was made from.
So this is like the original stuff that the lithographer would use to create the posters.
And would show then the show owners and say, this is what we have in mind. Do you like it or not? These next two examples are kind of a parody on circus poster art. This middle one obviously has monkeys doing various acts, and again a local connection because they have a flying troupe there performing as the Flying Cancellos.
And the Welendas act
right,
as well. So
exactly.
We have all animals doing this.
With Dorothy Herbert on horseback.
And a pretty little poodle that she's riding.
Yeah, exactly. And then another piece of early Ringling Brothers Barnum Bailey Circus poster art in almost cartoony format.
And so as we move down a little bit, we have some great black and white photographs.
Yeah, this was part of the Clyde Beatty Circus in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and you have the owners, Jerry Collins, Frank McCluskey, Walter McCluskey, Bill English, some of the people affiliated with the show, and of course, they didn't see the need to identify Clyde Beatty, but there he is.
These are some casual photographs of Clyde
Absolutely.
Beatty.
Absolutely, behind the backyard scenes, I guess is what we would call it, behind the curtain kind of scenes.
And you recently were given a big collection of Clyde Beatty stuff, so this is a nice addition.
It is a nice addition, and it gets us even closer to the man who was Clyde Beatty.
And what are these beautiful, colorful songster little things that we see here?
Aren't they neat? These range in date, and this is just a few samples from the songsters that we were given by Herbert, ranging from 1882 up to 1890.
What is a songster exactly?
What is a songster? It's fantastic. Great question. It's the songs of the day.
Oh, wow.
So you have the music, you have the words, and this is how music traveled the country before people had a lot of radio sets. You know, they went to that circus and they heard that song. It was so catchy, they want to play it on their piano or...
Here's one called The Baby's Got a Tooth.
Yes.
So, more poster art over here. Mark, what is this?
What this is...
I'm surprised. Tom Mix! Tom Mix himself with Tony, his horse!
I know! You are good. You are that good. Yes, well, Tom Mix and Tony were with the circus for a number of years, and Mark will delight in telling you how the local connection works there.
Tom Mix worked on the Sam B. Dill Circus, and then Sam B. Dill, I believe, died. And Tom Mix took over that show. And while Tom Mix had his own show, he ultimately married Mabel Hubbell, who was known as being part of the Flying Ward. She was Mabel Ward. And Tom Mix, his final wife, was Mabel Ward. And
it all just keeps coming back to Bloomington
it
Normal.
It does. It's crazy cool.
And this is really cool because it's only partly filled in, colored in. It's partly finished. Why is that, Mark?
It's done to as an example of what the colors might look like. And so if they didn't like the colors, they could change it in the rest of the example. And you can sort of see that in the note that they're saying
the sketch is okay as is. I want rich lemon yellow used for the ground with a bright, eerie red lettering around it. Oh, that is really amazing.
And 15 sheet, if you consider that this poster behind you is one sheet, imagine 15 of those pasted together. That's what they're talking about. So this thing would have been huge.
It would have been like, it could have filled a block.
Yep.
A whole block of on along a fence. And we have a headdress right next to this. I want to put this on, except that wouldn't fit my head.
Right.
So where does this beautiful, spangly, feathery headdress come from?
Well, you can see from the label that it's from the Brooks Van Horn Company out of New York. And we have a name, and then we have some numbers there. That name will help us identify who wore this particular headdress.
Adamson.
Adamson.
And I see the number 12.
Yep.
and then just a series of like numbers underneath the comb that holds it in the hair.
Yeah, and
so that's more that's some more research for you right there.
Exactly, and we are so blessed because we have ISU has Maritza Ataide on campus. She's the wife of Ivan Stoyanov, the assistant coach or associate coach, I don't remember his title, of Gamma Phi Circus, and she worked as a wardrobe mistress for a number of years with Big Apple Circus, and she is volunteering her time here. We're so thrilled that she's doing that because she's helping us identify who actually wore these costumes and when.
Have you guys uncovered something in this collection that really just took your breath away and you went, oh, I never knew that?
You know, we have never before this collection had in our collection any original poster art. So for us to see that, for me to see that, to see the Tom Mix piece, for example, was otherworldly. I had no idea that that's how it was done until we got that.
We have an awful lot of correspondence between the lithographers and the show owners, but before that, we never had the visual examples, and so that's so cool to they meet.
Maureen Brunsdale and Mark Schmidt of Milner Library talked with GLT's Laura Kennedy. In time, the new donation will be digitized so that online researchers can view the unique items. Donations from Herbert Eckert include hundreds of costumes, which will take years to research. See photos from the new collection, including some jaw-dropping photos of a contortionist in action, at our website, WGLT.org. There will be an exhibit of circus artifacts from the new donation mid-March through April at Milner Library.
Hi, I'm Kathy. I live in Anchorage, Alaska, and I listen to Bullseye because I really like the way that Jesse does his interviews, not just throwing softballs at people.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, I'm talking with Rian Johnson, director of Star Wars The Last Jedi, plus the band The Go Team. That's on the next Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Listen Saturday at 11 a.m. on GLT, News and Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Think twice before giving your dog a bone treat. The Food and Drug Administration recently issued a warning about bone treats that are commonly available from retailers. Though all dogs love bones, those treats could injure your pet or worse. Laura Kennedy has more on this edition of Animal House.
The FDA recently logged about 68 reports of pet illnesses related to bone treats. There's a variety of bone treats commercially available: ham bones, pork femur bones, rib bones, and more. Dogs that ingest bone treats can experience choking, gastrointestinal blockage, vomiting, cuts to the mouth, and other problems. Many pets suffer enough to warrant a vet visit. Worst case scenario, death. Not only should you avoid commercial dog bone treats, but avoid sharing bones from the kitchen table. As much as dogs dig bones, they don't really need them. Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal says we give our pets bones because we think it connects them with their wild roots.
Take them back to their original lupine heritage when they were wolves. And we've really changed these animals around a lot, so they're not as tolerant. And so we have all sorts of stuff that's available out there with treats, much more so than with the, especially the larger producers of dog foods. But with some of these treats, there's clearly a quality control issue. Backing up even farther from this specific report, we've had recent problems with dog products from China, which took a while to figure out. It was kind of a mystery ingredient that was wreaking havoc. We've had issues with particular jerky treats having toxins with our companion animals. So it's sort of like, don't get fancy and don't humanize your dog's need for variety and appetite, because that's how we get into trouble. There's a whole slew, and if we just kind of go through them, the ones I like people to know most about, human food's always the big one. If you absolutely have to do it, stick to super bland and super boring.
Huh.
You know, stay away from the sauces, stay away from the skin, stay away from bones, stay away from anything that has gristle or fat or oils on it. You know, pizza crust is okay, stay away from the pizza. Breads and just boring things. Dogs love the act of getting a treat. They're not sitting there writing up food reviews on the foods that you're offering them. So you can make their tails wag just by giving them their own kibble as a treat, honestly. This is not a timely agoraphobia for everything else that's going on in the world, but simply avoid the stuff that's not made in the States. There's been enough problems with Chinese-sourced products that if there's a made in China, don't use anything that's made in China. The jerky treat bad press has me convinced to stay away from the, especially the avian turkeys, the chicken jerkies, turkey jerkies, but kind of just with the bad press that went down, avoid the jerkies. People love to give their dogs hard things like antlers and bones, even those boiled bones that are meatless. And those aren't probably going to cause a major problem. They can cause obstructions. One of the things that's really underappreciated is how often we see slab fractures of the big chompers in the upper dental arcades. If you look,
wait, just chomping down on a bone,
working a bone, and they'll slab fracture the outer portion of that big tooth, and then you can see it if you lift the lip back and up on your dog. Especially cats have them too, but they're not as dramatic as in dogs. You'll see this huge tooth, we call it a carnassial tooth, and we frequently see chips off the little point, which sometimes get up into the root canal. Now we have an issue for potential for tooth root abscess down the line.
Ooh.
And that's a really unfun tooth to take out. We get paid taking those teeth out, but it's not a way we want to take your money. And then the slab fractures, which sometimes will slab off enough of the tooth that it's sitting there like this free chunk of tooth that's wobbling in and out of gum, but really still attached to the gum. We can't just pull that out. We got to knock the animal out, take that slab out, or if that slab's up into the root, which it often does, you'll be able to see a significant part of the tooth root. The tooth needs to come out because it's painful and it's uncomfortable, and that's frequently a cause of just these chewing on antlers, chewing on the really hard stuff.
Why is it these dogs are dying? Are they choking on the bones? Are they splintering these bones that they're getting in these bone treats that they can buy at any pet store?
They had a combination of blockages for sure, some of these smaller bones that can be swallowed. Dogs can... I'm laughing because I'm thinking of some of the things we've pulled out of dog stomachs that were intact. You know, a teddy bear that looked like it had been put in there.
Oh, my goodness.
A potted houseplant that sprung up like, you know, like a Jack in the Box when we opened this dog. It was a big pit bull. This plant just, boom, like, ready to go. Put it on my windowsill. The teddy bear is the same thing. He was like, hi. You know, he's like looking at me. Just hardly damaged dog. So they can get an enormous size down their throat. But the problem is when it has to get out of the stomach through that little pyloric valve that goes into the intestines, and the intestines, of course, their barrel's much smaller. So getting it into the stomach's the easy part. Getting it out of the stomach is where we get into a lot of problems. Our kind of personal favorites are some of these American-sourced, larger, pressed raw hides that aren't flavored. They give, they get soft, they chew. Those and the dental chew products that are out there, these big kind of wavy, leathery flaps that are infused with some dental enzyme stuff, these products do help with teeth. They don't tend to hurt the teeth. We still feel you need caution if you give them one of these big pressed rawhides, as they mow it down to a size that looks snackable, throw it away and give them another one. The dental chews are mostly meant to dissolve and be digested. I've used them for a long time with my dogs. They did sometimes get stuck like up in between their upper arcades, and you'd have to help them get them out of there. But in terms of obstruction, one of my dogs likes to swallow them early. He gives them a little bit of an issue, but it's not going to be a foreign body issue. So those big pressed raw hides that aren't soaked in flavors. They have a little resistance, but they give when they're chewed, and they're manageable in size. And then any time you give your dog anything new, make sure that it's at a time when they're not having GI distress, which, you know, if they're feeling good and they have a good appetite and they're not vomiting, their stools are normal, that's a time to try a new treat and see if they tolerate it. Just anytime you introduce something new to a dog's GI system, and we're talking primarily dogs, the cat treats issue out there hasn't been as dire.
But, because people don't want to turn their cats into panthers. It seems like trying to give a dog a bone, you want to just sort of honor his wolf roots or something.
It's true. Cats get, they get catnip, which is by and large a completely benign, and a lot of these little package treats that just seem to be benign also, whereas dogs are the ones who are getting parts of animals and jerkies and knuckle bones and all these things. Always watch your dog when you offer it a new treat, because some dogs, even the really safe, benign treats, will still result in an upset tummy, and that just means don't use that one anymore.
That's Dr. Matt Fraker from the Prairie Oak Veterinary Center in Normal. Kongs are a good bone alternative. Just make sure you keep it full of peanut butter to keep your canine happy. I'm Laura Kennedy.
If you have any pet-related questions for Animal House, let us know at WGLT.org or post your questions on our Facebook page. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/WGLTFM. You can also tweet a question. We're all at WGLT News. I'm at Mike McCurdy, and that's also how you can let us know what you think of what you hear on Sound Ideas here on WGLT Normal, made possible today thanks to Laura Kennedy, Charlie Schlenker, and John Norton. Find the individual stories and interviews you hear on Sound Ideas at WGLT.org. You can also subscribe to the full show podcast at our website or at iTunes. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.